If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And for the last, 10 years, I will say no year can be complete ever without at least one, hopefully more than one, conversation with this great lady of dogs, the queen of dogs, because she is from the UK. So that's where the queen reference comes in. From It's Me or the Dog and Positively.com. You know who I'm talking about. I know who I'm talking about. And I rarely know what I'm talking about. Here she is, Victoria Stillwell. How's that?
Oh, it's lovely to be back.
Was that a good introduction? Did I do that okay?
Yeah, you did. I always love your introductions. You know that.
Nobody
who introduces me like you do.
Well, there's so much to talk about. And lately, for those who follow, and I encourage anyone and everyone, professionals in the dog training world, but anyone and everyone who loves dogs, to follow positively.com. And you've been talking a lot about reactive dogs and a new program and new ideas that you have. So let me back up a little bit and let's first describe what reactivity is and what reactive dogs, what they are.
Well, I think if you would ask people that have a dog that's showing reactive behavior, it's dogs that are either at the window or in a car or at the end of a leash, are barking and lunging, sometimes showing teeth. Their behavior is very active. They're making a lot of noise. The physical movement can be quite, dogs are very strong. So you can see handlers often sort of trying to hold on for dear life. That's reactivity. It's quite a loud behavior.
And what we, well, let me ask you another question first. Then I'll say, this is the thing about talking to you. I have 20 thoughts in my mind at the same time. So are we seeing more, or are you seeing more reactivity today than, say, 10 years ago?
I think so, 100%. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is because as our lives get busier, as the places we live are busier, as there is more noise, as dogs are confined more, as dogs are more unemployed, they are doing less jobs for us like they used to. That, I think, is contributing to dogs that are unfulfilled. Their needs are not being met. They are poorly socialized. They don't know how to cope with the environment. And so they react accordingly. And a lot of people, when they see this reactive behavior, they might say, oh, the dog is being disobedient. Oh, the dog is being nasty or bad. And it's not that at all. Reactivity is the friction between the dog and the environment.
Well put. All right. So we tend to be human beings. That's our problem. So when the dog does that, for instance, lunges to the left, we tend to pull to the right. Or we holler at the dog, no, 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 no. And or sometimes we go to a dog trainer, he uses a shock collar because that's going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. All three of those responses clearly are incorrect. Can you talk about why?
Well, I think that people see reactivity as a character trait, and it's not. It's not a character trait. It's not in the dog's personality. As I said, it is the friction between a dog and the environment. And it can be triggered by things that the dog is very excited by, very frustrated or agitated by, that they are nervous of, that they fear, that they've had a bad experience with, that they have had trauma with. So there are so many reasons why dogs react. And humans, when they deal with it, the reason why I'm trying to say to people, look, when I do work with clients and I say, look, your dog, it's not your dog's personality. This is just your dog's response. Because, and they're quite shocked when I say it, because I'm like, look, I ask them the question, is your dog reactive in all kinds of environments? And the answer to that most of the time is no, they're not. They're not reactive when they're sleeping. They're not reactive at home. They're not. So therefore your dog is not reactive. It's not a reactive dog. Your dog shows reactive behavior in certain environments where it feels frustrated and uncomfortable.
All right, let's talk about each of those options. So The dog is pulling all the way to the left and growling and barking at maybe another dog or a bicycle coming toward the dog, whatever it might be. Why is that, pulling the dog the other way, a response that doesn't communicate much, if anything, to the dog?
I think it's just our natural response. And we're trying to survive as much as dogs are. And this behavior can be very worrying. It can be embarrassing. It can sometimes be really dangerous. And so that is, it's very normal for people to react in the opposite way. Get the dog out of there as much as possible. Pull the dog away. Tell the dog no. And so when we're working with reactive dogs, we understand that that's what people do. We're not berating them for it because everybody would do that. It's just now we're giving them different skills to cope.
I want to talk about dog physiology, too. And even not reactivity. The dog is just pulling on the leash. If the dog is pulling that way and you pull the opposite way, let's talk about what then the dog, you're communicating to the dog, will even pull her further, harder in the direction. Talk about that a little bit.
Definitely, it can encourage dogs to pull even harder, because if you think about it, your dog is trying to cope with the environment. You're trying to pull your dog away. By doing that, you're hampering your dog's ability to cope with the environment in the way that it's doing so at that moment. You're making your dog feel more vulnerable, and that's why they pull harder.
And it's, I think, called the opposition reflex. So if the dog is pulling one way and you pull the other way, the dog is just going to pull harder.
100%. Especially, yes. And it's not, that's not the case with every dog, but that definitely can happen.
Absolutely. All right. So dog trainers, some, will say, I've got the solution to this. We just slap a shock collar, who they often call an e-collar, as if that's going to make it better, on the dog. And now we're going to have a dog that doesn't do it anymore. And in truth, for a while anyway, sometimes that dog with the shock collar around its neck isn't going to be reactive anymore. Sometimes. But what are you teaching the dog? And note, I'm making a point of saying sometimes. We're going to find out why Victoria Stillwell, I happen to know, says that is not at all the correct thing to do when we come back on WGN with the great Victoria Stillwell from It's Me or the Dog. We'll be right back. Her website is positively.com. Her name is Victoria Stillwell. I'm Steve Dale on WGN, Steve Dale's Pet World. And we're talking about, as you and I have done on and off over many, many years, Victoria, shock collars. And for a while, they seem to have gone away a little bit, but now it seems they are back more than ever before. That's my impression. I'm curious what your impression is, and tell me about using shock collars in general, but specifically for dogs that we were talking about called reactive dogs.
Yeah, I agree with you. Unfortunately, I think shock collars are making sort of a comeback in because social media is very seductive, right? And so when you see it on social media, oh, it looks amazing. But what you're doing is merely suppressing behavior for a bit. You're not changing the way the dog feels. You're not teaching the dog anything except I see another dog, I lunge at it, and I get hurt. Other dogs equal pain. And that is not going to be good if your shock collar doesn't work, if it malfunctions, or if your dog's not wearing it. And then sometimes what happens, well, not sometimes, a lot of the times, it doesn't matter if your dog's wearing a shock collar. It's going to do what it needs to do, whether you are pressing that remote or not. And that is the tragedy. Therefore, you build up a punishment callus. You shock and shock and shock and shock. And what worked before is now not working because the dog pushes through that. It is so desperately sad and abusive. It is abuse. And that's how these shock collars work. And it just makes me feel so sad when people say, yes, but when they're used properly. Well, when they're used properly, they are designed to inflict pain on an animal. Purposeful discomfort. It says it on the label. Shock collars, e-collars come with warning labels saying that you shouldn't use them on dogs that are showing aggression or reactivity or this. And there's a reason for that. Why? Because it makes it worse. In the long run, you might get your little quick temporary fix, but in the long run, you are just making it worse.
There was a lawsuit that you might or might not be aware of, a class action lawsuit in California. And I forget the dollar amount, but right, it was millions of dollars. And the lawsuit indicated that the shock collar, just what you just said, does more harm than good, but it's not advertised for that. And they won this huge lawsuit as a result of that. And nations, entire countries, ban the use of these devices. And you'll be happy to know, I don't know that you know this, but because of the resurgence of shock collars, I don't know how else to put it, but the, as you said, increased use, because in part of social media, and also known, and I want to ask you about this, as a sort of last resort. So the dog bit, the dog did whatever the dog did, human-animal bond is fractured, and the only way to fix the dog and the bond is to use a shock collar. But I'm out there talking to veterinarians at a couple of conferences about this, because I think veterinary professionals have a place in all this to communicate the truth. And I think sometimes they just don't know. They're not necessarily taught behavior. So I offer the science, of which there is plenty of. So what about the notion of using a shock collar, as some say, as a, well, everything else failed, so a shock collar will save the dog's life?
Oh, yeah, that's an argument that's always used. And I always say, well, why would you use a shock collar to save the dog's life? Because there are so many other ways where you are not causing the dog pain. You're not intimidating it. You're not causing it to fear you without using the shock collar. And in fact, what we are doing when we are using more positive methods with dogs, yes, even those dogs that we need to save their dogs, their lives, because they're in shelters and they're on the kill list, even with those dogs need understanding. They need resilience and confidence to be built. They don't need to be suppressed and threatened all the time with a shock collar. I think it is such a warped message that is being sent to people. But I just have to say that when you're talking about veterinarians, we even have the president of
The AVMA,
the American Veterinary Medical Association, saying that in certain circumstances, shock collars are okay. That is a travesty.
Well, I'm working on that. It's this show, you may not be aware, but it's this show that he said it on. And in fairness to him, it was like literally, and you do media all the time. You host television. Like, it's me or the dog on Animal Planet and elsewhere. So you know how it is. I mean, there was literally less than a minute to go. And I thought he would just say, it was kind of a throwaway question. The whole idea of the interview was to ask tough questions. And we talked about the economics of veterinary medicine and vaccination concerns, because now you've got these anti-vaxxers who won't vaccinate dogs, believe it or not, because they're concerned about the dog getting autism, stuff like that. So we were talking, and it was a fine conversation all the way, but less than a minute left, I said, well, what about shock collars? They seem to be making a comeback. And that's when he said what he said, and I really didn't have time on the air to have a rebuttal with him. But from what I understand, off the air, he's beginning to understand the truth, if you will. And I will say, the American Veterinary Medical Association, as an organization, supports positive reinforcement. And it seems to me,
yes,
Victoria, right, it seems to me, if you support positive reinforcement, you can't support shock collars, because they are so completely opposite.
And look, it's all about education, isn't it? So veterinarians, as we know, as you said, they don't have a lot of teaching in behavior. They have too much to do dealing with all the animals that they need to deal with, right? And I love, I'm very supportive of veterinarians. But behavior, they need to listen to us too.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important, the trainer and veterinarian relationship is a really important one.
And the diplomates of the American College of Veterinary Behaviorists wrote, Dr. Lisa Radasta and colleagues wrote a beautiful and well-explained, scientific-backed reply to everything. And that's the thing. What we're talking about now, Victoria, is not only your opinion or your experience regarding shock collars, it's all science-based also.
Oh, it's absolutely science-based. There was a study done about with shock collars very recently and dogs chasing. And that study was highly flawed. But one of the things that it really showed was that every single dog in the study who had a shock collar on, and as they were chasing this thing, they were given a cue, and then they were shocked, they yelped. Mm. And the quote was, presumably in pain. And that was that one sentence just demonstrated even a study that was done to extol the virtues of shock collars proved that dogs were yelping in pain when the shock was administered. Now, there are so many other studies done that's more sort of anti-shock collar, but I thought that was a really interesting study to showcase exactly what we're saying.
I like that, and I may use that in my next talk, actually. I've got to look that up. Victoria Stilwell is here, and when we come back, I want to talk about, okay, what do you do? We talked about what you don't do, but what do you do, what can you do with reactive dogs? Dog Bite Prevention Week isn't that far off, and I want to talk about a new way to think about that as well on WGN. Sometimes I just love to answer one of your questions. You can email steve@stevedale.tv. And I chose this one because I don't recall ever answering this particular question before. Why do pets get zoomies? We've all seen it. Dogs or cats bolting back and forth, running down a hallway, maybe running at breakneck speed throughout the house or around the backyard in circles for a while. It's really common, especially in young animals, but any animal of any age. And there's actually a scientific term for this. It's called frenetic random activity periods. And that's kind of what they are. They're great for pets, and there is an explanation for this behavior. In part, it may be hardwired, as wild cats and wild canines do the same. From lion cubs to wolf pups exhibit this behavior as well. And so do a lot of other animals. I mean, donkeys and pigs. Yeah, pigs. Zebras, countless other species. Even our cousins among the world of primates, like gorillas and bonobos and monkeys, at least many monkey species. They do this. Why do they do this? To build muscle. It helps with coordination and confidence for younger animals, or at least that's what it's thought. But there's something else more. Something else more? There's one more thing when it comes to our pets, and that is we give them often positive reinforcement for doing it because we're laughing at them because it's so funny and it's fun to watch. And that positive reinforcement supports anytime you give positive reinforcement, they're likely to repeat that behavior. And that happens, maybe that's a part of it too. So there are 8 common triggers in pets for this release of energy. One is after a nap. Another is after doing number 2, not number 1 so much, just number 2, if you know what I mean. After a bath, you dog owners know exactly what I'm talking about. At certain times of the day. So that's more common in cats, where a cat ritually at about 6 o'clock every night, or I don't know, it depends on the cat, at 10 a.m. in the morning, whatever, will do it. Due to pent-up energy, maybe as a result of being indoors due to inclement weather, dogs will do that because they haven't released that energy. After a brief play session, leaving a pet overstimulated and simply still too excited when something great happens, and the pet doesn't know what else to do. Like you come home from work, so the pet says, I don't know what else to do, so has the zoomies. Or sometimes after a meal as well. Interesting stuff, huh? Oh, I got to run. Check it out, positively.com. There's an academy that we'll talk about as well that you can learn, oh my gosh, so much about dogs, occasionally cats, at positively.com. I still say you ought to change it. And positively.com, one of the best websites out there, Victoria. But what I believe you need to do is add another one, Purzitively, P-U-R-R, like in...
I leave that to you, Steve. I've got got too much on my hands with just the dog.
Well, I've been trying to convince you for, what, 15 years or something like that?
Yeah.
But one day maybe. All right, so what do you do? We've talked about what not to do, but what do you do with a reactive dog?
Well, we use and have developed what we call the reactivity zones approach. So basically, there are three zones: the comfort zone, the tolerance zone, and the discomfort zone. Comfort is where you would love your dog to be. Tolerance is where dogs are a lot of the time, especially those that are not fully reacting, but they're uncomfortable. And then discomfort is when they're fully reacting. So what we do is that we find out what the triggers are, what environments reactivity happens, and we teach dogs skills, dogs and handlers, skills on how to cope in each zone, the tolerance zone and the discomfort zone. And so in the discomfort zone, we teach dogs how with their handlers to get out of there. In the tolerance zone, we teach predictable patterns of movement to allow dogs and handlers to move through that zone. And we're always trying to get back into comfort. So when I'm working with a dog that is showing reactive behavior, their comfort zone is very small. The tolerance zone is much wider and the discomfort zone is huge. What I work on is to shrink the discomfort zone and shrink the tolerance zone so my dog's mostly in comfort. And it's all about skills for dogs and handlers.
And there's much more, I will say, because I've read a lot of it, on the website, positively.com, where, by the way, if you happen to love dogs, there are opportunities for you to learn a lot more. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we have courses for dog lovers, and a lot of them are just 30 minutes, and you can learn all about body language, managing your dog's energy levels, about teaching resilience and creating confidence. And we also have a course there called Help Stop Reactivity, where we go into how you deal with reactivity. But we also, at the Victoria Sewell Academy for Professionals, we have a new professional course called Reactivity for Professionals. And those are for dog training professionals that want to learn more and go deeper into how to deal and work with reactive dogs and their clients.
And all of that available at positively.com. And
Go ahead. Positively.com, but also at the Victoria Sewell Academy. So we have two branches. We have positively.com, which is for everybody, including guardians and dog trainers and animal care professionals. And then we have the Victoria Sewell Academy, which is where you go to if you want to learn and become a professional dog trainer.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit, because many times people have come up to me or emailed and said, how do I become a dog trainer? And maybe not just like that, but they've asked. And I often give out your information to do that. How important is it that you're ahead of me, I think. How important is it that someone is properly trained to be a dog trainer rather than just putting up a sign saying, I'm now a dog trainer?
Well, it's vitally important, right? If you're going to be a hairdresser, you have to learn how to cut hair in order to be a hairdresser. Any kind of skill that you or job that you want to go into, you've got to learn how to do it. The same is with dog training. I mean, I think when people come to the academy and they realize the extent of knowledge they need to have, because we're not just talking about handling dogs and teaching dogs to sit, stay, and come when called. It goes way deeper than that. And we're talking about how to understand dog cognition and emotion and anatomy and physiology, how the brain works, how the body works. And we're also go very deeply into human psychology as well, how to talk with humans, and we talk about the business side. So our course is online, but every student gets a faculty advisor, which is a live person that they meet with and takes them through the course as well as me. I'm not live, but I take them through myself and other faculty. And so they can do it in the comfort of their own home, but they can learn this amazing skill that they then get assessed with, and then hopefully they pass and become a certified dog trainer. But it does take minimum 6 months to a year, and it's intense. And we owe it to dogs. We must respect dogs and dog trainers that this is an art form almost, that this comes from, if you're going to be a good dog trainer, you have to learn, you have to gain the knowledge. You can't just set yourself up and go, I'm going to be a dog trainer, because you're really going to harm dogs if you do that.
Mm. I don't think most people want to do that, but people sometimes like shortcuts. And increasingly, my hope is that the general public will look for credentialed dog trainers. And there are several other organizations that credential as well. But there are organizations out there that credential. And we were talking about shock collars. And there aren't many of them, but there are a few. So also, I suggest people become educated about the trainer they are hiring before they hire the trainer. I think, Victoria, the best way to do that is to go to a class first, audit the class. And what I say is, if you get that funny feeling in the pit of your stomach that the dogs are not being treated right, or the human beings either, then listen to that feeling in the pit of your stomach.
Yes, and or do your research. Talk to people that have taken their dogs. Be careful if they say, you know, you need to have a prong collar or a shock collar for your dog. Or, you know, be careful of the doggy boot camps out there.
Mm.
Be very wary of those. There are some people that will do board and train, but when you say, hey, this is doggy boot camp, invariably those are shock collar trainers. So you have to do your research and talk to people that have been to this trainer. And if you feel like the trainer that you have hired is hurting or harming your dog in any way, you have absolutely every right to tell them to stop.
Yes, I totally agree, fully agree. But I also agree that there's an importance to dog training, assuming the person is doing it the right way with positive reinforcement, for a variety of reasons. But the most important reason for me isn't only to teach sit, down, stay, roll over, or whatever. It is to open the window of communication between what amounts to one species to another.
This is a profession where that is what we teach. It is how do we help understand dogs, foster stronger bonds between dogs and humans, understand what dogs need so that dogs and humans can live in harmony. And because you and I, Steve, have been so involved with Dog Bite Prevention Week every year, it is also vital for safety. And that is whether you have a dog or not. If you have a child that goes on a play date, if you are going to a friend's house, if you're walking in the park, you want that dog to understand and that person to understand that, A, not everybody likes dogs, but to have that dog under control and to ensure that that dog is emotionally stable.
And, you know,
and
dog,
that is what dog training does.
Yeah, I agree. And dog bite numbers happen to be going the wrong direction. They're going up. So I think we're missing something regarding all of that. And that's what we'll talk about, as Dog Bite Prevention Week isn't too far off. Victoria Stilwell is here on WGN. From It's Me or the Dog, Victoria Stilwell on WGN Radio, positively.com. That's the website. Yeah, you and I for years, Vic, have been involved in one way or another communicating about dog bite prevention, often in conjunction with the American Veterinary Medical Association. And, you know, there have been two efforts throughout the years. Both of them go back many years regarding dog bite prevention. One, a researcher, John Fuller, from the University of Chicago, and I'm trying to think of where else he worked. I had the opportunity to interview him once. He was quite elderly at the time, and he was living in Chicago at that time. And he, Bowling Green, that's where else he was. And he was famous, Scott and Fuller were famous for understanding and publishing about what they called, I believe, the critical period of socialization for dogs and how important, how necessary socialization is. So that's one thing. The other thing that also goes back many, many years, before I was even around, that you see a dog on the street you don't know, ask, can I pet your dog? Perfectly makes sense. But I say we're missing something. And I think what we're missing is to ask the dog, which happens to be the name of a book I wrote for kids, do you think this makes sense? And I know you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense. I'm so glad you've written about it, because children especially need to know, but parents also need to know.
Mm-hmm.
Adults need to know. Yeah, it's fine to ask the person, and you should. But then what about the dog? That doesn't mean just to say you go and approach. Now it's the dog's turn to make a decision whether they want to come and say hello to you or not, whether they want to receive your attention. And that is that missing link that so much of the time when these things came out to begin with, it really wasn't considering dogs. It was trying, but it wasn't really giving dogs a voice. Now we're giving dogs a voice. Now your book is saying, hey, let's focus on these guys and let them tell you whether they want to say hello or not.
Exactly. And, you know, what started all this, there I was down the street from where we live with our then 17, maybe 18-year-old dog just sniffing at the grass. Another dog, a mid-sized dog, just sniffing at the grass. A lot of dogs around where we live, which is one reason why I love where we live in Wrigleyville in Chicago. And I'm not paying attention to the dog or the woman who's holding the dog at the other end of the leash. But then out of nowhere, the woman says, don't you want to pet my dog? And I look at the dog instantly, and the dog is pulling the leash sort of in the other direction. Its ears are down a little bit, but there's no growling or barking. I mean, no signaling that is clear. But to me, it was clear. This dog was saying, I don't want to interact with this dude. Now, maybe the dog doesn't like strangers. Maybe she lived in that direction and the dog was simply hungry. I don't know. But it doesn't matter why. Why push yourself on the, never mind the fact that it was kind of odd that she would say that to me. But, and she walked away angry when I said, no, thank you. I don't want to pet your dog. But you understand, I think, the gist of what I'm saying. I mean, it doesn't mean the dog would have bitten me, but certainly it's a scenario where the dog might have. I have no idea.
And it is a scenario that plays out every single day when people and children go up to dogs and don't ask, or even when they do ask, they still get bitten or snapped at because the dog hasn't consented.
Aha. And this, I think, perfectly said, and this, I think, is also true for dogs who live with us and love us, that maybe for whatever reason, that 6-year-old who goes up to the dog and assumes just because it's my dog, this dog wants to be hugged or this dog wants to be held at this point in time. And maybe the dog is trying in several different ways that we don't pick up on, sometimes don't even care. We should care. And we need to learn how to pick up, I think, on what dogs are telling us.
And I think dogs are amazingly tolerant of rude human behavior. As much as we see hugs as being affectionate, for dogs it means something different. But they are tolerant of it. They're amazingly tolerant. And that's just, I think that shows how incredible they are.
I agree. And I think that National Hug Your Dog Day, and there is such a thing, should be eliminated and changed to National Love Your Dog Day. I'm fine with that. But, you know, dogs, Victoria, and you said it, I mean, they're not primates. They're not born understanding what a hug is. They either learn to tolerate it because they are often as tolerant as you said, sometimes like it because they know attention comes with it from us, but mostly don't like it, and every now and again, the dog hurts because maybe the dog is arthritic, or maybe the dog, for it doesn't matter why, is just saying, no, we don't pay attention or care, and then a bite happens, particularly to kids.
Yeah, and that again, is a tragedy. But, you know, the signals, I think if kids can be taught signals of how dogs can respond. So a lot of people, for example, if a dog goes on its back when you greet it, you don't know it, but the dog suddenly flips on its back and shows you its belly. A lot of people will go, oh, the dog wants its belly stroked. But that's not what the dog is saying at all. This is language, which is basically called a cutoff signal, which means I do not want to interact with you. So understanding that, and that difference between when your dog that you know and that adores you and is comfortable with you does like a belly rub, people have to be taught that difference.
Do you think that if people better understood dog as a second language, that we'd have fewer dog bites?
Yes, and there are this curriculum now in certain countries in Europe that are not only teaching children to be more empathetic and understanding of dogs and animals in general, but are teaching in that curriculum, as part of that curriculum, how to interact safely with them. And I think this needs to be taught in all schools. It shouldn't be something that's just an addition. There's so many dogs now in this country. I think it needs to be even a small part of the curriculum so kids know. And once kids learn it, they're going to lap it up. And I think this is vital. I think this would reduce the number of dog bites in this country.
Well, you know what I think about you. You are absolutely the best. That is positively.com. She is one of the favorite voices of folks I speak to on the radio or speak with on the radio. And her name, of course, Victoria Stillwell from It's Me or the Dog. Always a pleasure, Vic. Maybe some frog species have it right, and we can learn from them. Ladies, you tell me what you think. When a female frog doesn't think the dude is good enough, or she's just not in the mood, she has a solution. She pretends to croak. And I don't mean ribbit, ribbit. I mean she plays dead. A handful of frog species have been directly observed using what's called tonic immobility, or playing dead, to escape persistent guys. You know how guys are sometimes. So the female rolls over on her back, goes completely limp, and they can remain motionless for a few minutes or maybe even up to an hour or so. So next time you see a frog which you believe has croaked, maybe check her pulse first. We will talk to you next week, bright and early, here on WGN.